This meeting of the House Transportation Committee can now come to order. It is 1:06 p.m. on Thursday, May 8th, in room 124. Members present are Representative Moore, Representative Tilton, Representative Mina, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Eichheit, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please silence your cell phones. And before we begin, I'd like to thank Suniva St. Clair from House Records and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Our committee aides are Griffin Sikeu and Meredith Trainer. Thank you both for your help. And it is Staff Appreciation Week, so I just want to say a moment of gratitude for all staff in the Alaska Legislature and in our building.
Mm-hmm. Moment of silence.
Or a moment of silence. On today's agenda, we will consider amendments on House Bill 136, Railroad Utility Corridors, from Representative Kopp. We then have a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on the Highway Safety Improvement Program. And finally, a first hearing on House Bill 217, Autonomous Vehicle Regulations, by the House Transportation Committee. I'd first like to invite Representative Kopp and his staff to the dais to provide any comments to the committee. And we did hear this bill on Tuesday, so I don't know if we need a refresher on the bill, but if you'd like to offer any opening comments.
Thank you, Chair Carrick and Chair Eichheit, and very much appreciate the committee hearing this bill. Just in conclusion, Chair Carrick, House Bill 136 affirms the state's right and obligation to set policy for how the railroad easement is managed. The Alaska Railroad is a state-owned corporation, and it is the state, not the railroad, that holds the authority to determine when exclusion of property owners is justified. This bill is about balance between the legitimate operational needs of the railroad and the longstanding rights of Alaskans who legally own the land beneath the easement. The bill reaffirms that property owners may use their land in ways that do not unreasonably interfere with rail operations. It's a common sense standard that already governs easements in Alaska and nationally. Multiple cases at the Supreme Court affirm this. The Alaska Supreme Court in the Godspeed case reaffirmed that the underlying landowner is affirmed to allow non-interfering uses of the easement. That was a 2020 case. Some individuals have expressed concern that House Bill 136 might preclude the railroad's ability to authorize public trails. To directly address that, Madam Chair, the bill was amended from version G to version H with the help of the co-chairs to clarify that nothing in House Bill 136 prevents the railroad from approving public trail or infrastructure projects. That subject is addressed in House Bill 142 and is an appropriate vehicle for that policy. House Bill 136 doesn't give landowners veto power, and it doesn't interfere with the railroad's ability to coordinate with state or local governments on public works. The bill does set a clear and fair policy. If you own land beneath the easement and your use doesn't interfere with railroad operations, you should be allowed to use it. The current uncertainty stems from what we believe is a flawed Ninth Circuit Court interpretation of the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act, and this just simply restores a balanced Alaska-based approach consistent with our legal history and our values. I urge your support for this bill. And it's about respect for private property, responsible governance of public infrastructure. It preserves the railroad's ability to approve public projects and manage operations, and gives us some clarity where confusion has taken root. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. And at this time, we can open up our amendment process. We did receive one amendment by the deadline from Representative Mina. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Amendment number one was drafted in response to a lot of really good discussion on this topic about property rights and the railroad. And I know that with a lot of the testimony in opposition, there were so many concerns about the Fish Creek Trail, other trails. Hearing from the bill sponsor and talking to the bill sponsor, I understand that his intent, and as stated on the record, is that this bill is not just about a trail. And so from hearing the other testimony, I know that there have been other concerns in the past related to property owners near the railroad, on the railroad, charging fees, and also just having frustrations with that. The railroad presented on Tuesday and said that they have changed their policy on fees related to gardens and other property owners doing things within the right-of-way that doesn't inhibit the railroad operations. And then additionally, that it is their current policy to issue revenue-neutral crossings. And so this amendment takes what the railroad is already doing and helps to ensure that to property owners that they won't be charged fees on gardens, even if the railroad changes their leadership. But then additionally, that it continues the railroad's policy of revenue-neutral crossings. And I worked with the bill sponsor and with the railroad on this amendment as well. And I want to make sure that this is a bill that's not about a trail, but it's about addressing property rights issues in the railroad.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment to this amendment number one, if you don't mind. Amendment one deals with fees and permits. The Alaska Railroad can charge private landowners for railroad crossings. What I'm proposing is simple. It follows the same logic but applies to our own public agencies and utilities. This amendment would make it clear that the Alaska Railroad Corporation may not charge a state agency or public utility a fee to use a railroad or railway utility corridor. It makes no sense for a state-owned corporation to be charging state agencies. We're just shifting public dollars from one agency to another, one pocket to another, and probably losing some red tape in the process of this amendment. These are our emergency services, our transportation agencies, our utilities. The Alaska Railroad is our railroad, and we're doing the work of the people. So let's not make it harder and more expensive for them to do the job. The amendment would add a new subsection C that simply says, the corporation may not charge a state agency or public utility a fee to use a railway utility corridor. Since we're already talking about fee authority in the section of the bill, now's the right time to get this cleaned up. I think we're transferring money. I think the DOT pays $1.5 million to the railroad for right-of-way fees. MEA is significantly less, $20,000-ish. Doesn't make sense for the railroad to be charging MEA, who is a member-owned co-op, and is the ratepayers' fees go up because they have to pay a railroad that is owned by those same members that are in the co-op a fee for a right-of-way. So again, it's just shifting money, and I think that this is a logical amendment to just stop that from happening to ratepayers and to Alaskans and to our other departments. So that's a conceptual amendment.
So can,
and I have copies if you want.
So Representative McCabe, let's take a brief at ease to distribute copies, and then I'd like to have you state the motion again on the record, just by itself. Could you do that before we take an at ease?
Yep,
if you could state the motion.
So immediately, I make a motion that immediately following new subsections A and B in amendment number one, insert a new subsection to read, the corporation may not charge a state agency or public utility a fee to use a railway utility corridor.
Okay, and I'm going to object for discussion, and then we're going to take an at ease so we can distribute the conceptual amendment. At ease. House Transportation is back on the record, and we are under discussion on conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one, also known as H.5. Is there discussion on the conceptual amendment? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I appreciate the conceptual amendment, and I think it's there is a good discussion to be had about the railroad's fees and making sure that we are educating the public on those fees and being transparent about that. I oppose it only because the original intent of my amendment is to take what's currently the railroad's practices as presented in their presentation on Tuesday and to codify them in law to help assuage property owners that feel like they are being charged or they might be charged by the railroad in the future for having access to their property within the 100 feet right of way. Since this is a new policy that is not reflecting the railroad's current habits, I will not support it.
I'm going to put myself in the queue. I'm curious, I know we've caught her off guard here, but can we get Ms. Clemens to come up and comment on this conceptual amendment?
Certainly.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be House Transportation. And for the record, it's delivered with utmost sincerity, but anyway, for the record, Megan Clemens, External Affairs Director for the Alaska Railroad Corporation.
Great. And Ms. Clemens, could you offer any comment on Conceptual Amendment 1?
Certainly. And with apologies for, you know, sort of in real time getting thoughts organized on this, I would say, you know, there are real expenses associated with road crossings. And, you know, from the railroad's perspective, we understand that it's important that we can't simply block access from one whole half of the state to the other. You know, we bisect a good swath of the state. So we understand it's important for the public and for private owners to be able to access the rail line. That being said, those crossings are a burden to the rail system, and it's standard across the rail industry that it is the crossing, you know, the road crossing user that assumes the cost and the maintenance of those crossings because they are a burden to the rail system and a benefit to, you know, the drivers making use of those roads. That being said, there is a state policy that covers road crossings that was developed in 1988, shortly following the transfer to the state, and that was developed between the Alaska Railroad Corporation and the state DOT, and that outlines the state's policy towards road crossings, both how they are you know, new applications are considered, you know, the diagnostic team studies that are required to develop those, as well as sort of the pricing and expense share, again, with that falling to, you know, whether it be DOT for a state road, the relevant, you know, municipal entity, or if it's a private, whether residential or commercial private crossing. So it would be a concern for us to assume all of those expenses. I can tell you, as was mentioned in the presentation on Tuesday and reaffirmed in Representative Mina's amendment, you know, our crossing program and the fee structures therein are designed at a high level to be revenue neutral. You know, you hear a lot from us when we come down to Juneau talking about the importance of the railroad's statutory model as a self-sustaining organization. We do not see the crossing program as a profit center. This is understanding there are some real expenses associated with building the infrastructure and meeting the regulatory requirements, and those are the expenses that are passed along to whether it be DOT or other entities.
And I'm going to add a follow-up here, and then we'll go to other committee members. Do you have a ballpark? I'm not looking for precise because I know this is on the spot, but just a ballpark of what the corporation takes in for fees on state agencies and then also for public utilities, just for both of those entities.
You know, I'm so sorry. I don't have off the top of my head an answer to that question. I did just quickly dig up an email from a couple of years ago in response to this inquiry from Representative McCabe. And in 2022, DOT's annual feeds with the railroad from a sort of real estate permitting perspective came to $82,000, just over. And from an annual signal maintenance total was just over $250,000.
Okay. I'll leave it there for right now. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. That's a huge discrepancy from the number that Representative McCabe mentioned earlier. But you somewhat answered my question that I had, which is, what do you base these fees on? It's not a profit-making situation. It's actual expenses to the railroad to maintain these crossings?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, that's correct. So some of that is internal administrative time, some level of paper pushing and reporting to the FRA, the Federal Railroad Administration. So there's some staff time associated with that. There's, track inspection, crossing inspections that happen throughout the year, twice weekly. Standard, we do inspections of all of the crossings as part of our general track inspections, but the crossings do get more time. Incidental maintenance, I will say if there is larger maintenance required, part of the permit agreements would have that be a reimbursable expense to the permit holders for the crossing, but for incidental small maintenance throughout the year, that would be covered under sort of annual permit fees. The diagnostic team study, candidly, that can be a not inexpensive process. Again, the requirements for that study are laid out in that 1988 state policy, but that will involve at a minimum, the Alaska Railroad, state DOT, the relevant borough or municipality, depending on the location of the crossing in question, could involve school districts or local law enforcement. That's a study that will identify the, specific considerations of a proposed location, whether it will need to be a passive crossing or a signalized crossing. The level of expense associated with that based on the perceived risks. Those studies can be, north of $10,000, which is not, again, a small number. We appreciate that fact, but, we try to make people aware of those when they submit their applications.
Follow up, Madam Chair? Thank you. Through the chair. So, obviously, as you indicated, you have an agreement with the state and with DOT already, so I don't know how appropriate it is at this point for the legislature to get in the middle of it in a situation like this. However, if you could maybe provide to the co-chairs, what revenue the railroad is receiving between the power companies and whomever else, that would be appreciated.
Okay.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Ms. Clemens, so what is the cost for an NSTAR pipeline or a MEA utility or electric line that's buried underneath or alongside the railroad? What is the yearly cost to you that is maintenance cost that the railroad would have to absorb if this... So here's the deal. I had a long conversation with NSTAR about putting in a gas line alongside Point McKenzie. And their comment to me was, we want to do it before the railroad takes control because we pay a huge amount every year in right-of-way fees to the railroad. So I don't have the amount, obviously, notwithstanding the difference between the DOT's amount and your amount. There's some discrepancies there, and it'd be great to get to the bottom of it. But there's a buried pipeline underneath the railroad. Why would we be charging a yearly fee to NSTAR or a utility for that? It doesn't take any maintenance. There's no signal crossing. Even an electric line going over the top of the railroad. I've heard that story. Apocryphal information I get, but you're charging as well for that. So, what's the real story from the railroad's perspective.
Sure. To the chair, Representative McCabe, that's a good question. I apologize. The amendment does cover not only road crossings but also utilities, and I failed to address that in my earlier responses. So when it comes to utilities, this is where, you know, again, you hear from us all the time, that model of being a self-sustaining corporation does come into play. And so we do charge, a fee that, you know, rolls to our real estate revenue for longitudinal utility lines within the corridor. We do also charge if there's needed maintenance access, that is on a revenue neutral basis, just based on, regulations associated with providing flaggers for access to the corridor for safety reasons. So there can occasionally be additional reimbursable costs there. But yes, to your question, that would fall under the railroad statutory mandate to be self-sustaining. And our ability to lease our land to provide revenue to support our capital investments in infrastructure.
Follow up. Thanks. So what I hear you saying, and follow my logic here, the Alaska Railroad is owned by the Alaska people. That land in the railroad right-of-way, granted to you by the, I get that it's granted to you by the Federal Railroad Administration for safety purposes, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, that land belongs to Alaskans. Mm-hmm. And we are charging Alaskans through NSTAR because that's the ratepayers, right? The ratepayers are going to pay that. We are charging Alaskans more money for the land that they already own, for use of the land that they already own. You follow my logic? You see what I'm saying? And so that's sort of the problem that I'm having with this, as well as the whole DOT issue where we're charging another state agency to cross land that other state agency really already owns. Not the signal maintenance. I'm talking about rights of way, and there's a huge disparity there. I get that, but I don't understand why the railroad is charging Alaskans to use their own land. Probably more of a comment than you don't need to answer that. So that's my struggle with this, and that's why I put this in there. It's different in other states where there is. The railroad is not necessarily owned by the state, but in our case, we own the railroad. We own the railroad. It belongs to us. Why would we charge ourselves for something that we own? That's my struggle.
I'm going to go to Representative Stutz, and then I'm going to ask the bill sponsor to comment on the amendment.
So, two things. NSTAR is not a publicly owned company, is it?
No.
So, I understand why NSTAR is being charged. You know, that's, to me, that makes sense. But that wasn't my original question, Madam Chair, through the chair. Thank you. This is just for my own curiosity. Are the railroads fiscal, is there information available to the public, or the legislature or whoever might, is there a website where we can go and look and see what the financial information is on the railroads?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, our annual report has our financial information in there broken out by our real estate revenue, which is available. Some of our contracts are proprietary just to, protect the privacy of our customers. So there's a limit to the granularity of it. But yes, our financials are public, and I can send over that information.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's ask the bill sponsor to come comment on the amendment, and then we can take any additional discussion. Thank you, Ms. Clemens. Representative Kopp, I would ask you to come join us.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. And to the main amendment and the amendment to the amendment, I definitely appreciate Representative Mina and the spirit of that amendment. And then to the conceptual amendment, I appreciate Representative McCabe's speaking to monetizing the easement. The original easement in the Alaska Railroad Act was for rail, telegraph, and telephone are utilities. In fact, it is Matanuska Electric Association that has filed amicus briefs highlighting that they have no voice to even negotiate the rates that they pay. And John Sims has said several times of NSTAR he pays more for 1 mile of access to the right-of-way when that's the only way he can move natural gas than he does for the other 800 miles of pipeline right-of-way in Alaska that NSTAR has. So Representative McCabe is just simply bringing up an important issue: is do we want any way, to provide a check and balance on how those rate structures are set? So I would just say that I appreciate the spirit of that. I am aware that DOT has said they pay about $1.6 million a year in fees to the railroad because of crossings. Andy Mills, actually, from DOT, gave us that information. I'm sure they would email the same thing. So if you want a number on that. This is a policy call of the legislature. And so both on this and, of course, Representative Mina's amendment, I think the spirit of that amendment was great. I realize they're kind of both connected, but those are my comments.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Is there additional discussion? Representative McCabe?
So, yeah, thanks through the chair, and the discussion is really just a statement, but in response to Representative Stutz, NSTAR might be a private company, but they are a utility company, and the costs that NSTAR incurs are passed off to Alaskans via a rate increase or a rate payer, and that's exactly, Representative Kopp said the same thing that I heard, that the rate is there's no possible way to negotiate it. What do you do? Because you have to go through this utility corridor, and we're trying to make very clear that through the railroad that we own, we are passing the costs on to ourselves, and I personally have a problem with that. So, hence the amendment.
Co-Chair Eichheim.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. This is an interesting discussion. The thing that is difficult for me is the different numbers I'm hearing. It's really super helpful for me to have numbers that are vetted, printed out. I would love to know more about these agreements. I'd love to have DOT here, NSTAR here, hear that testimony. So I guess I'd like to continue this conversation later, so I can't support the conceptual amendment, but it certainly gives us something to meet on in the future. So, thank you.
I just will note for committee members, Andy Mills is online for a different item on today's agenda, but if anybody would like him to comment, we could ask him to. Representative Stutz.
Thank you. I don't necessarily disagree with this, but to have it put like this without being able to look into it, particularly when the state has an agreement with the railroad, maybe that's where we need to start. And I appreciate that because it's a big concern. It's a big concern, but it I don't know what the fallout of doing something like this or even Representative Mina's amendment right now would have and what effect it would have. So unfortunately, it's not because I don't like it, but I just think it's a little premature at this time for me to support it.
Yeah, I guess I put myself in the queue. I really appreciate the spirit of this amendment. I'm a little shocked by some of the numbers that have been brought up today, and I am concerned about that. I'd like to hear more from the railroad about where those charges are happening and how much they are, especially regarding the public utilities, as has been mentioned, and the impact that that has economically downstream for folks. But I don't have the information to make this decision on the spur of the moment, and especially because we can't get accurate information on how this impacts the revenue of the railroad right now. So
happy to ask the question to Andy if you'd like.
Sure. Let's go ahead and ask the question to Andy Mills about costs to... I'm trying to find him.
Where'd you go, Andy?
Mr. Mills, would you like to comment on costs to DOT in fees from the railroad?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Andy Mills, for the record, legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So the information that Representative Kopp did share earlier is accurate, as there were questions about this, and we did provide some of that at that request. 1.6 million is what was identified just for Northern Region, but it was over a time period of FY21 to FY25. Certainly, we could work to get what Central Region also has. And again, there's a distinction that I believe has been made on railroad signal maintenance, which is all separate and identified as short of about $500,000 annually, and the repair and maintenance costs for crossings, which we should keep those conversations separate.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Mr. Mills, through the chair, I'm just curious. Was it 1988 agreement that Ms. Clemens referenced? That had to do with signal maintenance and road crossing and that sort of stuff, if I'm not mistaken. And forgive me, but it's been a while since I read that. It didn't necessarily have to do with fee charging for right-of-way. Would I be correct in saying that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I actually don't have that background with me, but I'm happy to get that back to the committee. Certainly, that goes back a bit, and so happy to provide some additional context along with perhaps that agreement so that this committee can have that in background.
That'd be great. And Chair Carrick, I don't want to blow up whatever you're doing with this, so if it is... looks like this is not going to pass because people are confused, I'm happy to offer it in a different committee or even on the floor after we get the amendment. So I guess I'm not the chair, but I would look to the will of the committee. And if you don't want to pass it and you just want to go ahead with Representative Mina's, I don't want to torpedo Representative Kopp's bill in any means or delay it at all. So I guess it's whatever your will is. I'm happy to
well. Representative McCabe, I might suggest that you withdraw the amendment for now, but I will also just be clear, like, I would like more information from our public utilities and the railroad and from DOT. I'm not sure if I would support it with that information, but I think it would help me feel a lot more comfortable about the impact, and it would put me a lot closer. So right now, I am not comfortable supporting the amendment. So you know, we can absolutely take a vote on it if you'd like, but I do maintain my objection. So
thanks, Chair Carrick. Having sort of reading the room here, I think that I will withdraw conceptual amendment one to amendment one and allow us to move forward with the majority leader's bill.
Okay. So conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one has been withdrawn. That brings us back to amendment number one. And I would just ask if the bill sponsor could comment, just now that we're only on the underlying Amendment 1, if you have comment just on this amendment.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I appreciate the spirit of Amendment 1 offered by Representative Mina. We did hear testimony from a landowner that has a private crossing, Mr. Mathis. And the committee is probably familiar with the several private crossings if you've ever been to Seward for their 4th of July, down when you go by Kenai Lake, Renfro's Lakeside Retreat, and there's actually many homes that for 60, 70 years have maintained private crossings. And as you heard from Mr. Mathis, they're paying $1,000 a year. Now, the railroad may think that's revenue neutral, and it would be, I think, good to get some guidance from the committee that when you have a private crossing that the private person is maintaining and has continuously maintained for many decades, $1,000 a year is not quite revenue neutral. You know, it may be maybe $50 administrative fee would be revenue neutral, but that's where these people are at, and that's why they're so anxious about it. A lot of these are very elderly people that are on Social Security income, and these fees are really onerous to them. And it's not like they've sprung something on the railroad. It's just been their family land for generations. So I entirely agree with Representative Mina's bill, and I think having it in statute is very wise. But revenue neutral, I think, still leaves it, you know, to an administrative agency, maybe a little more direction, even a statement from this committee on what you think might be revenue neutral to help guide them. I'm not quite sure how to put that in statute, but I think there's a lot of landowners that, you know, would appreciate the spirit of this amendment and maybe even being a little more prescriptive on what revenue neutral means. Yeah.
Looking for any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none. Thank you for offering your perspective. I think I had initially been the one to object to amendment number one for discussion, so I'll remove my objection. Is there objection to amendment number one? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one, also known as H.5, passes. Thank you, Representative Mina. So we are now on House Bill 136 as amended. And at this time, I'd look to the committee for any additional discussion on House Bill 136. I suppose as co-chair, I'll start. I just want to thank Representative Kopp for bringing the bill forward and for the very robust discussion we've gotten to have on this topic. I represent an area which does not have a lot of intersecting uses with the railroad, but I actually live right next to a railroad tracks on either side of me. So, but I have heard from a lot of folks both in the interior and especially in the Anchorage area and around the state on the issue, and it seems to me that there's definitely a need for some kind of better clarification and resolution around issues related to land management near railroad right-of-ways for homeowners or for potential other developments, including trail users. And I appreciate the discussion around House Bill 136 and the inclusion of the perspectives of all of those different stakeholder groups. So I am just really grateful for being able to have that. Any additional comment or discussion? Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I just wanted to thank the bill sponsor and a lot of the public advocates for their input on this bill. I think there is a good discussion to be had about property owners' rights and the railroad and trying to reconcile those differences. And when we talk about these issues, it's not just about trails, it's about fees. And to be able to provide more clarity on some of those tensions and make sure that it's not just about one trail in Anchorage, but it's about all these different issues around the state for property owners who are impacted by the railroad, I think it's good to provide that direction. I know a lot of the testimony are many trail advocates and cyclists that are in my district or who we've worked with. I do care about having more, you know, multimodal options and active transportation in the state. But this bill should be about trying to reconcile other issues that property owners have with the railroad.
Thank you, Representative Mina. Additional discussion? Co-Chair Eichheim.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I too appreciate robust dialogue. You know, this has been a fascinating process. It's also been highly educational. The history is very interesting. You know, there's not only the greater history of railroads in the United States and Alaska specifically, there's also a history of things that have happened in the past that have maybe created some distrust. I think I understand maybe that's what's led to this. I think there's been good dialogue with the Railroad Corporation. I think they've heard everything loud and clear. I do appreciate the sponsor having made some changes to committee substitute, trying to address the concerns of potential trail uses. And I would like, you know, as I stated in a previous meeting, it is a statewide issue. And as the sponsor has said many times, this is not a trails issue. And the sponsor has assured me that that's in his other bill, and has stated, you know, this should not affect potential trail uses like the Fish Creek trail. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but I do get sometimes concerned about the meanings of words, how they might be used. We just were talking about what is it revenue neutral means. So I'm always concerned about how words are construed in bills. So I appreciate the robust dialogue, and I hope this can move us forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Eichheit. Very brief at ease. House Transportation is back on the record. Thank you all for the discussion. I would look to Representative Stutes for a motion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I move that House Bill 136, 34-LS0640H, as in Henry, move from the Transportation Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 136 has moved from the Transportation Committee. Take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. House Transportation is back on the record, and we are back with House Bill 217 now, which is from the House Transportation Committee. Here to present to us today for our first hearing is my co-chair, Representative Eichheid's co-committee aide, Meredith Traynor. Welcome, Ms. Traynor. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. Through the chair, Meredith Traynor, House Transportation co-committee aide and staff to Rep. Eichheid. House Bill 217, Autonomous Vehicles, is a Transportation Committee-sponsored bill and the companion bill to Senate Bill 148 offered by Senator Myers. We thank Senator Myers for the opportunity to offer this bill here in our committee. Among other changes, House Bill 217 seeks to add language and regulations defining autonomous vehicles to Chapter 28 of statute for the first time. This bill establishes requirements around use of autonomous vehicles in Alaska. In particular, it establishes a requirement that autonomous vehicles utilized in interstate commerce, shipping of commercial goods, and passenger transport require a human safety operator who meets federal and state requirements for operating autonomous and non-autonomous vehicle operation, and that they be present in order to operate or shut off the vehicle as needed. This bill notably does not impose the human operator requirement on autonomous vehicles being used for transport of interstate commerce goods or passengers when that use is for personal, non-commercial purposes. However, it does maintain the same requirement that any human safety operator in such vehicles meet the same federal and state requirements for vehicle operation, safe vehicle operation. In addition, the bill establishes guidelines for owner and user liability in the case of an accident, with allowed exceptions where there is clear and convincing evidence that the vehicle's software or hardware or a modification to the vehicle caused the accident. Section 1 of the bill establishes a pathway for liability in case of such events that begins with the human safety operator and ends at the manufacturer. Finally, the bill establishes definitions for a number of new terms related to autonomous vehicle technology and function. You can see these terms on slide 3. They include autonomous technology, autonomous vehicle, conditional driving automation, dynamic driving task fallback, full driving automation, high driving automation, and operational design domain. The effective date for this bill is immediate upon passage enrollment. And that's it. Thank you very much to the committee for the opportunity to present House Bill 217. I would be glad to take any questions. And thank you again to Senator Myers and his team for offering this bill.
Thank you. Co-Chair Eichheid, and then go to Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Ms. Traynor, thank you for that excellent presentation. I might be a little bit out of the loop, but I've never ridden in an autonomous vehicle. But, you know, I hear about them and I read about them. I think it's much more common in the lower 48 with certain vehicles. And I hope someday to rent one and try it out. Have you had any experiences with self-driving vehicles?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Eichheid, through the chair. Yes, I have, in fact. Actually, I was in a Tesla and had the driver of the Tesla chose to put it into the self-driving function, and I've had the opportunity to navigate a roundabout in a self-driving vehicle that was autonomously being driven.
And
follow up.
What was that like? Any weird things happen?
Through the chair to Rep. Eichheid, Meredith Traynor, staff to Rep. Eichheid. The car did end up rubbing against the curb in the roundabout. The driving was imprecise, and I would compare it to the experience of being in a car driven by a high schooler who's just getting comfortable driving. Kind of rubbed the tires on the roundabout.
Follow up. Just final thought. It's a new emerging technology, and I appreciate this bill because, especially when you're talking about larger vehicles and deliveries. I think it's reassuring for me if there's a driver on board that can take control. I like that concept. I like the concept of if I'm in a bad accident in a normal car on the side of the road and in the future some kind of delivery truck was coming by and that was self-driving but had a person on board that could stop it and render aid, I would most appreciate that in that personal situation. So thank you for your presentation.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So the biggest question that I've seen so far, and I've got several emails on this, is the whole operator making having an operator there kind of defeats the entire purpose of a self-driving vehicle, right? So the biggest question, one of the questions I have, is the definition of interstate commerce. So if I build something and put something together in my garage and I want to do send it across town, it's not really interstate commerce. It's, you know, I'm sending something across town, so intrastate, right? So I'm wondering if there is a difference there. I'm also wondering about drones and how they're covered, or I'm sure there's a definition somewhere that says driving in vehicles versus drones or airplanes, but I haven't been into this bill yet to explain or to look at it. But and I am also concerned. I mean, my wife's Bronco has lane keeping and all that kind of stuff on it, which works absolutely zero of the time when the roads are covered with snow.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how – I guess I'm wondering about the mechanics of it. So it'll be interesting to see the sum total of all this with the – I don't know, maybe is it possible to have a presentation from a manufacturer or something sometime?
Yeah, I'll jump in. I would like to see a presentation from a manufacturer. I think that'd be interesting.
Or a ride.
I am curious, and if Ms. Trainer knows the answer – or would like to opine, since you've done a little bit of research on this now. You know, AI technology is something on the cutting edge, too. Right now, it's still pretty clunky. If you're familiar with computer-generated images, then you can sort of tell when something is AI versus when it's not AI-generated. But we're already kind of to the point where you can't tell that with text anymore. And so as this technology evolves, I just wonder how quickly we may reach the point where the vehicles don't seem like they're being driven by teenagers. And if you'd like to comment on, is there still at the point this technology evolves, perhaps even in the near future, where having a driver present as a backup is still of value?
To the chair, Meredith Trainer, staff to Rep. Byshid, thank you for the question, Rep. Kirk. I think that in considering this bill, what struck me as most noteworthy was the importance of defining autonomous vehicles in statute. In the motor vehicle section that I saw, there is no other language around autonomous vehicles. It's a new enough development that essentially, and perhaps Senator Meyer's staff would be interested in adding comments if I'm erring in this department, but I didn't see anything in statute about autonomous vehicles, and yet we know that they are increasingly being used on the roads and that they are being considered for shipping. And given the nature of interstate commerce and considerations around shipping to Alaska and how important that is for us, it does seem appropriate that we mindfully consider how we want to regulate that use of that technology and that industry. It also seems possible that in the future there will be a point where it's not necessary to have a human safety operator. But based on my experience in that Tesla, I didn't hate having a driver available who could take over the controls when we were rubbing the curb.
Yeah. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, I don't even know if it's, a, it's not a question. It's just talking. embarrassed to admit this, but my son has a Tesla that does all that driving on its own. And I've seen it. It does very well. I mean, totally with nobody in it going where it needs to go, which is very shocking at this point in time for folks, I believe. And I personally have been in it when it has been on the highway, and it's done when he's put it in the drive itself mode, and it's done a fine job of driving itself. But that being said, he was still sitting there, so that was a more comfortable feeling for me as a passenger. So I guess to your point, Madam Chair, Co-Chair, is that as we move further along in technology, probably the better that these vehicles are able to navigate themselves. So more of just a statement, and I'm going to go home during this interim and ask if I can test it out, maybe.
Put it in ludicrous mode.
It does play the American flag song, and all the doors open and all the windows do all that. Yes. Anyway, thank you for the leniency.
I think it's fascinating that back in 2000, we were envisioning flying cars as the cutting-edge technology, and here we are in 2025. We don't have flying cars still, but we do have now autonomous vehicles, and that wasn't something that was being regularly talked about then. Mm-hmm. I am also curious, and this might be more of a question for Senator Myers himself, but in states that have these, or in companies or however, that have drivers present for shipping, do they have the same requirements for awareness as drivers do currently? So, for example, with autonomous vehicles, like, can the driver take a nap even though they're present in the car, or can they do other activities, or are they required to have the same exact level of awareness as they do currently?
To the chair, Meredith Trainer, staff to Rep. Eichheit, I can't speak to that today, but I'd be happy to go and do some research and get back to the committee on that question.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to find out. Yeah. Representative McCabe.
That'd be really interesting to see if you could get off of a DUI if you were in a self-driving car and the cop stopped you and said, you look like you've had a few too many tonight. Boy, I got a self-driving car, officer. It's driving me home. That's one that I didn't even consider until just right now. It might be something that we are going to have to, this body's going to have to figure out eventually, I suppose.
Well, what I will say, having tried to define electric bicycles, it is helpful to have definitions in statute.
Just can't get over that.
Ms. Trainer?
Through the chair, Meredith Trainer, staff to Rep. Eichheit, speaking to Rep. McCabe. Actually, in this piece of legislation, it does note that a human safety operator must meet federal and state requirements for operating autonomous and non-autonomous vehicles. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, assumedly that would cover not driving under the influence, and where a safety operator is required, not being under the influence if you're in the vehicle and it's being operated.
Okay.
Cool.
Any additional questions or discussion? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, I was just looking at some of the different letters of opposition, and just one thing that I'm curious about from the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. One of their concerns is that this bill doesn't reference National Society of Automotive Engineer definitions. Has that come up in the bill presentations in general about the definitions in this bill and national standards?
Through the chair, Meredith Trainer, staff to Rep. Eichheit, to Rep. Mina. I took a look at those standards, and what's interesting about the SAE standards that are referenced is they define incremental increases in the level of automation in an autonomous vehicle. So from like a fully autonomous vehicle to vehicles that have things like the type of lane correction that we discussed earlier. I think I haven't heard, except for that letter, I didn't see correspondence that directly addressed those standards, but it certainly seems like something that could be elaborated on specifically in this bill, and that where I would imagine we might hear testimony in a public testimony phase when it's time.
Thank you.
I would also note that I should have just read the bill, because the bill answers my earlier question about could a driver be doing other things besides awake. In section 1, line 10, it says that a human safety operator is physically present in the vehicle and has the ability to monitor and intervene in the vehicle's performance, including operating and shutting off the vehicle. So in answer to that question, I think the answer is you have to basically be as alert and aware as you would if you were driving the vehicle yourself. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions or discussion? Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, just the other point that was brought up in the Alliance for Automotive Innovation letter is that if there's a car crash, that the presumption of liability is going to be on the human safety operator, and they brought up this is not congruent with other bills mm-hmm. that look at tort law. Mm-hmm. Do you have a response to that?
Through the chair, Meredith Trainer, staff to Rep. Aishide, to Rep. Mina, in considering the same section of the Alliance for Automotive Innovations letter, it struck me that in the bill as currently written, it starts with the operator being primarily responsible and then progresses to the maker of the vehicle through four, you know, a total of four steps. In my understanding of tort law is that actually in a normal car accident, we start with the driver, right? The driver has the liability for being at the wheel when at the time of the accident. And then ultimately down the line, if it turns out there's an issue with the manufacturing of the vehicle or there's a problem, a mechanical issue with the vehicle, that might shift responsibility to the manufacturer. I think the opportunity there with regards to this bill might be to eliminate that particular part of the bill text. But even without doing so, my understanding is that the same parties would be responsible in the same order. Whether you write it in that way or not, it's sort of, perhaps it's a redundancy.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Awesome. Seeing no further comment or discussion on House Bill 217 today, I think what we'll do is set the bill aside until next session, but I really appreciate the opportunity to bring the concept forward and hope to work with the committee to make any changes or improvements in the bill and ideally see this move forward in some form. Thank you to Ms. Trainer.
Thank you.
At this time, we have a final item on our agenda today, which is a presentation on the Highway Safety Improvement Program from the Department of Transportation. And we'll take just a very brief few to pull up the presentation. House Transportation is back on the record. We have the presentation pulled up for us now, and to join us today, we have Pam Golden, who's our state traffic and safety engineer at DOT. We also have Christine Langley for our division operations manager at DOT in the data modernization office, and Andy Mills, our trusty DOT liaison. So feel free to unmute and put yourselves on the record and begin the presentation.
Okay, sound check.
We can hear you, thanks.
Okay, excellent. Pam Golden, I am the state traffic and safety engineer, as you mentioned, for DOT. I am based in Fairbanks. I'll do most of this. If Andy or Christine need to pop in, we can have them introduce themselves at that point, if that's okay.
Yep, that sounds great.
Okay, so are we on the... I can't honestly see. So
we are on slide one, Ms. Golden, and then if you just want to tell us next slide, we'll shift them for
next
you.
Next slide, we'll jump right in. So this is, you know, what is the purpose of the HSIP? The Highway Safety Improvement Program has been around in some form or another since the 60s. It became the Highway Safety Improvement Program with the Safety Lou federal funding, which was 2006. And it sort of, you know, has evolved a little in that time, but not a whole lot. The primary goal of the HSIP is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries on all roads open to public travel. So it doesn't have to be a state road. It can be a city road. It can be a tribal road, a local road. All roads are eligible except private ones. There are three things that make up the Highway Safety Improvement Program at the federal level. One is our Strategic Highway Safety Plan, which we talked about the last time I was before this committee. The other are our Highway Safety Improvement Projects, which is what most people think of when we talk about HSIP colloquially as we're around doing our projects. And then there's also a rail highway crossing program to eliminate hazards with rail highway crossings. At the federal level, we are required to have a data-driven program for our HSIP, as is every state. Questions?
Seeing none, I'll stop you if we see questions.
Okay. Then I'm ready for the next slide. So the HSIP, it's codified in Section 148 of Title 23. And really, all that matters is if you go to that section, you'll see 29 types of projects that we're allowed to spend the money on. It includes the construction of things, which is what people are used to. It also includes how we collect and analyze data, specifically calls out being eligible for connected vehicle technologies, road safety audits, transportation safety planning. So when somebody calls and asks us to evaluate a speed limit or something to that effect, that is something that we use our HSIP dollars for. New in the most recent bill, we're allowed 10% of our apportionment to be spent on what are called specified safety. So these are new things that we can spend money on, which is kind of the educational components, supporting law enforcement, supporting EMS, which there's an example of a project later I'll show you, doing research to progress safety, and non-infrastructure safe routes to school activities. So we can't go out and build facilities to safe routes to school. It's a specified safety project. They're just what we would call a regular HSIP project, but it does allow us to sort of cross over into that educational piece. Questions? If not, we'll go to the next slide. So where does the money come from? So these are different codes, but we have about 1.2 million that is railroad crossing funds, and we take our lead from the Alaska Railroad Corporation. They give us a list of what they feel needs to be done, and we work in tandem to support those issues. We have what we call our regular or uncategorized funds. We do have a 10% match on that. When we have more than 15% of our total fatalities being those with vulnerable road users, then 15% of our uncategorized regular funds must be spent on vulnerable road users. So that's about $6.4 million. We do trigger that penalty. We will trigger it next year as well, most likely. And then we have what we call our penalty funds. And these are transferred over from the Highway Safety Office. These are NHTSA funds that are transferred into the FHWA side, the highway side, as opposed to the behavioral side, because we don't conform with federal standards for open container and repeat offender laws. Those are to the tune of $26.6 million. So we appreciate them being transferred over into doing things that we can do on the infrastructure side.
We have a question here, Ms. Golden. Yes. Co-Chair Eichel.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the chair, Ms. Golden, the third bullet down on this slide, the vulnerable road user penalty funds, you said that we are going to exceed that we had, and we will again. What is last year's? Can you just give me a little brief history of where we are at with what percent of total fatalities are from vulnerable road users? And maybe you can define what a vulnerable road user is, too.
Yeah, through the chair, a vulnerable road user is anybody who is walking, biking, or rolling as they're using the transportation system. So pedestrians, bicyclists, but also folks in scooters, wheelchairs, those sorts of things. It does not include motorcycles, to be clear, though. Last year, I do not remember the number. I think we were in the ballpark of 15 vulnerable road user fatalities and 50 to 55 total fatalities. And I can confirm those numbers. I don't know them. I don't have them memorized today.
Thank you.
But so we will trigger that penalty this year as well.
And then, Ms. Golden, we have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Ms. Golden. So vulnerable road users, would that be electric bikes too?
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. We haven't really had to negotiate that yet, but I believe yes.
Ms. Golden, that's kind of a rhetorical question. I guess that did trigger a follow-up from me, though. Ms. Golden, does the Federal Highway Administration or state DOT have a classification or definition for electric bikes? Are they considered bicycles?
To the co-chair and to Rip McCabe. Sure, maybe, who knows? No, there's a lot of, we know the municipality of Anchorage has some rules as the federal crash reporting has to evolve to pick up not only e-bikes, but, you know, ATVs are legal in many states, golf carts are legal in many states, and that is something we're all sort of figuring out as we go.
Just open that wound right up and dump salt in the road.
Did you say golf carts are legal in many states? Mm-hmm. Road legal?
Mm-hmm. In some states, to the co-chair, yes.
Florida.
Arizona.
Arizona, Georgia, yeah.
That's interesting to me. Okay, I don't see any other real or rhetorical questions, so feel free to continue, Ms. Golden.
Sure thing. Thank you. Let's see, have you moved to the next slide?
Yes, we have.
Okay. All right. So people wonder, you know, where do these projects come from? So we have a Highway Safety Improvement Program handbook that is on our website. We just updated it. The new one got posted yesterday. So we updated. We were updating it yearly. We're now updating it with every funding bill. So we just got this one for the IIJA. Each of our regions does a screening process that's detailed in the handbook. Basically, it's automated to find any segment where there's been one fatality or two serious injury crashes and/or. And then they look at all of the crashes in that segment to look for patterns. They also look at whether there are similarities in more than one spot, and that's, we would call that a systemic project where they're applying it to more than one location. But looking at those, looking to find patterns, that's what we're really looking for. One crash can be a one-off sort of thing, but is it happening repeatedly, or are the same contributing circumstances across a locality or even the state? And then we're also figuring out how to look at other crash data sources. We talked about our partners in safety and our report of safety concern. We're looking at crowdsourced data that's more accessible and available in the Anchorage and Matsu areas where there's more cars, speed data where there's heartbreaking happening. So we're really trying to expand beyond the traditional a crash happened and either it was reported by a person, you know, through the DMV or it was reported by law enforcement. Questions?
I don't see any. Please continue.
Okay. So on the next slide, we talked about countermeasures in February when we were there, specific to bikes and peds and some of the things we look at. But once we've looked at those patterns, then we start looking at what types of countermeasures are proven to reduce those sorts of crashes. So the Federal Highways has their 28-29 proven safety countermeasures. There is a crash modification factor clearinghouse that you can go to and you can type in, I want to look at crashes with left turn lanes, and it will bring you up all the studies that have been dumped into that clearinghouse that address that type of crash. So there's ways we go out and do this. We don't just make things up. We're looking for proven countermeasures. So then we look, a regional traffic engineers find one or more of those countermeasures that might mitigate the specific type of crashes. And then we look at the context. Does it fit in that location? Not everything works contextually. So we want to make sure it fits. We look back at existing planning documents to make sure we're not doing something in violation of something that's been planned or that supports something that's, you know, already on the books. And then there's coordination with local governments, the metropolitan planning organizations where they exist, just to make sure that everything is progressing in lockstep with regional plans as well. Questions?
We do have a couple questions from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, Ms. Godin, I understand this slide. These are countermeasures to increase safety, you know, walkways, bicycle lanes. Can you briefly, do you have any knowledge about vulnerable user laws, which I know other states have, which, you know, essentially add some penalties to folks that are driving that harm or kill a vulnerable user, as you've already kind of said, walking, biking, or walking, rolling.
Biking.
Yeah, all those things. Is there, you don't have that on here. Do you have any information on how vulnerable user laws in states that have them, do they reduce safety issues, or do they assist folks with staying safer besides these good things like bike lanes?
Through the co-chair, to the co-chair. I don't have any information about that. That was something I first learned of from you a couple months ago. It's not something I've seen, you know, in sort of the webinars and things that are available to us. But it is something I can inquire about at upcoming traffic engineers meeting that I'll be participating in to see if other states do have any information on that.
Follow up? Yeah, I would appreciate that if that is effective in reducing vulnerable user accidents. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So Ms. Golden, I have a interesting question. So in the very bottom of your bullet there, it says coordinate with local governments for, and we're talking about countermeasures. So I have two local governments in my district that are not part of an MPO, the Trapper Creek and the Talkeetna community councils, that have requested a lowered speed limit on the Parks Highway within, say, a half mile either side of both spurs, the Petersville Road as well as the Talkeetna Spur. And it's been ongoing for 6 or 8 months. I'm wondering if that runs through your organization, if we can run it through you, maybe it'd be a quicker way to do it rather than the way it's going right now, because they bug me just about monthly on that.
Through the co-chair, Brett McCabe. So those are run through our regions. I can certainly check in with our central region folks and see what's going on there. But speed limits are set by the regions.
Follow up.
follow-up.
But as a countermeasure, that would be one of the countermeasures that you could step in and say, hey, you know, there's been enough accidents surrounding this road that maybe that would be a countermeasure? That was a question.
Through the co-chair to Representative McCabe. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that was a question. Sorry.
Okay. No, so I think speed limits are a tough one. Changing the speed limit without law enforcement really, or a major change to the road doesn't result in drivers changing their behavior much, which is why, as an agency and as a profession, we're hesitant to just pretend that the black and white sign is going to work magic. Crash experience is one of the reasons to lower a speed limit, but again, it's that law enforcement presence that really helps with the routine education of drivers in the area.
Okay, fair enough. So like a Talkeetna trooper's post would help. I'm just finding cool ways to get my message across. No, that wasn't for you, Ms. Golden. Thanks. That was totally rhetorical.
Ms. Golden, it's the last week and a half of session down here, and Transportation Committee is a little off the rails at the moment. please feel free to continue.
Okay, I've only got two slides left. If you will, I know we're probably over time, so the next slide, that photo right there, those are those sequential pilot flares. That was one of our specified safety projects that we are using to support first responders and EMS. That is the delivery of those to the interior regional EMS and some training. But once a project has been nominated and selected and chosen to be eligible into the program, statewide has reviewed it and, you know, said, yep, this is all good to go. Then we fund things in order of what does the most bang for the buck, what can be delivered fastest. Occasionally there's some fund management. Well, okay, we only have a little bit left, so we move a lower dollar program project up versus a higher dollar one. But we tend to find we always seem to have enough money at the end of the day. So I'll take questions on this one, and then, you know, there's just the one more if there's.
We can, Ms. Golden, we can actually just hold questions till the end.
Oh, okay. So if you do that last slide.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. Once a project is in the program, it's a project like any other project. If it's in the Metropolitan Planning Organization, the regions work with the MPO to get it into their transportation improvement program. But then it's normal design and construction, including all of the public involvement activities that go along with it. So the reason I say that is sometimes the scopes need to change. A project is either so untenable to the public, or something better comes up. A better option is realized. So there is a process we can go through to sort of re-deal with the scope and get it back into the program under the right scope. Our program is one of the few that has to actually evaluate how we perform. So once we have 3 years post-construction crash data, we do a final benefit cost calculation. We do report that in our annual report to the Federal Highway Administration. And we're pretty proud of the fact that we're at almost a 6-to-1 dollars, you know, this is a life saved sort of calculation, 6-to-1 for the money we've spent. So with that, any questions on anything?
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I just have a comment, and this is a purely selfish comment coming from Kodiak. Now, I had Chris Goings over to Kodiak this last spring, and I was just home this last weekend, and there is a road. And I cannot for the life of me understand what the problem is, but about every 3 months, you have DOT out there putting gravel in a hole. And now this hole is so big, and I'm looking at this, and it says transportation and public and safety, that if a car hits it, somebody's going to be hurt. And what's really frustrating is to drive by there and see the big pothole in the middle of the road that you can't swerve, and if you do swerve, you're swerving into oncoming traffic. And you know what's there? One of your orange cones right in the middle of the pothole. Why is it that they can't fix this?
So through the co-chair to Rep. Stutes, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is one thing that HSIP cannot do. We cannot repair. And it comes up fairly often, whether it's frost heaves in northern region, potholes in any of our regions, shoulders that slough off. Our program is restricted from basically doing what would be considered routine maintenance. So we can upgrade, and sometimes we use that strategically to upgrade things, but we cannot repair.
Hello? Well, this sounds like it's looking for an upgrade, and even if you can't repair it, I'll bet you a dollar to a donut you know somebody that can.
Probably on here. Andy Mills.
Yeah, well, we do have Andy Mills online if you want to ask him that
Andy?
question.
Andy? Andy? Did you hear me, Andy?
Andy, we weren't going to let you get out of this transportation committee this session scot-free.
Thank you very much. For the record, again, Andy Mills.
Was that a smile, and, Andy?
Indeed. It shows in the voice. So I do appreciate this question, because as Ms. Golden said, again, this type of funding actually illustrates sort of a more fundamental challenge for the department, in that federal funding often cannot meet many of the priorities and requests that we end up getting that are maintenance related. And I'll highlight, although I've had these conversations individually, M&O, or maintenance and operations, maintenance specifically, benefits from only a few dollars that we federal dollars that we have managed to work into our program. Otherwise, it is, you know, almost exclusively state funded, and state funding, of course, is where the last decade worth of reductions or flat funding has occurred. And of course, you may be aware, in this particular budget cycle, there are some reductions on the table for M&O, highways and aviation, or H&A. So that is the challenge we face. You are correct, of course, that projects or improvements to a road can deal with underlying subgrade or systemic issues, and we're certainly looking to do that across the state. But to get through to those improvements, which can take years or time, that we have limited resources for the very thing you are discussing, and we'll endeavor to, of course, to keep up with it, because you, again, are a great advocate for your district, as many are, so we appreciate it.
Just one last comment, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you. Andy, I appreciate that. And I wouldn't bring it up except that, as I said, this is so significant. I mean, a pothole is a pothole, and we all, you know what the old story is, if you can miss the potholes, they figure you're drunk. You hit the potholes when you're not. You hit the potholes when you're sober. And when you're drunk, you're able to miss them. That's the standard in Kodiak. But if somebody hits this pothole, there's going to be an injury. I mean, there's going to be a bad accident, and it's going to be a significant injury because there's no place to go. So I'll just call Kodiak's DOT. But thank you. Thank you for letting me spew. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Representative McCabe.
I actually think Ms. Golden answered my question. I was going to ask about the traffic signal in Kodiak that's been broken for 30 years, just trying to help my friend from Kodiak out.
But so I wouldn't whine about that.
30 years.
Yeah. Co-Chair Eichheid.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, Mr. Mills, this is for you, but I guess what I heard you say, and if I'm correct, I guess I'm trying to emphasize it, that the federal dollars we get, you know, help build new roads, but once they're built, the state has to take care of them. Alaskans, their money has to take care of them, and so that's the devil in the details, I guess. Is that a correct read, that the more that the federal government is helping us build these roads, but then the maintenance, which is, you know, very expensive as well, especially over time, is on the state. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair to the co-chair, again, Andy Mills for the record, that is an accurate statement, and it underscores why I know the legislature and the governor have both grappled with the motor fuel tax, which is a good example of a user fee for folks on the road. And of course, the more electric vehicles that go on the roads that are slightly heavier, the more wear and tear without that motor fuel tax that is paying for repairs. So it largely, there's a larger conversation here, but your statement holds up.
Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, what's HSIP's role in Anchorage's protected bike lane pilots? Were you part of that process?
Through the co-chair to Ritmina. No, that was through a research program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm looking around the room. I don't see any further questions or comments from committee members. Thank you very much, Ms. Golden, for being available today and giving the presentation. Also, thanks to Mr. Mills for answering those questions. I wish we could see you here in person, but I really appreciate you taking the time to call in and be available to this committee throughout the entire session. That concludes the House Transportation Committee for the session, actually. So thank you all very much for a great committee process. We heard and passed out a number of bills. We took on a lot of DOT-related issues. We heard about ferries and rail and cars. We are going to park the Transportation Committee for the year.
Chicken.
And Co-Chair Aishai, do you have any last comments?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. It's been fascinating to serve on this committee with everyone. I've appreciated the dialogue. I've appreciated the humor and the laughter. I've even appreciated the robust gavel pounding at times. So I'm looking forward to next year on this committee with you all. And I do really want to just say that on the record, Co-Chair Carrick has been a great mentor to me. I really appreciate her. And as I look at other co-chairs in the building, I think I'm the luckiest co-chair. So thank you, Co-Chair Carrick.
Thanks.
That's sweet. For the record, I voted for Co-Chair Carrick's electric bike bill last year.
Just yes.
I want to see the vote.
And just as a last note, I just want to also thank the people who actually make sure this committee happens, which is the staff of this committee, Susan Quigley, Sumiva St. Clair, and then the committee aides, Griffin Sikeu and Meredith Trainer. We would not have this committee without all of them, so thank you. And we'll see you all next year. With that, the House Transportation Committee is adjourned at 2:44 p.m.